For a while this year, we've been reviewing the Satipatthana Sutta, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Discourse. Lately, the conversations have been organized around the fourth foundation of mindfulness, mindfulness of mental phenomena, and specifically the five hindrances. I'm going to be talking tonight about skeptical doubt, one of the five hindrances. Previously, folks had talked about desire, aversion and ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor. Now we have skeptical doubt. Now, there is some kind of intersection between skeptical doubt and what goes in the mind, what we call restlessness and worry. And I will get more specific about reviewing that in a little bit. But the characteristic of a hindrance is literally what it does. It hinders one's ability to experience clarity in the mind and a quality of stability. Balance so that there's a certain amount of alertness and a certain amount of tranquility that are interacting together. So they're hindered when sense desire kind of agitates the mind. So does aversion and ill will. Sloth and torpor is when the mind is kind of, there's a deficit of energy, is more dullness and kind of a dreamlike quality. Restlessness and worry is a kind of urgency, an unpleasant urgency in the body, often accompanied by a worry line, so to speak. Now we've come to skeptical doubt. So the term in Pali is visicca. Excuse me, visikicca. Visikicca. I like to use the Pali words because one of the things that I really admire about the Buddhist doctrine is that it took the existing Sanskrit back in the day, and some of the terms were repurposed. For example, the word mindfulness, sati, basically was a Brahmanic discipline. The monks, the priests, the Brahmanic priests were supposed to perform certain rites and rituals. And they had to remember how to proceed perfectly. The more perfectly the rite or ritual was performed, the more benefit would accrue from that. So that term was sati. Buddha repurposed it. Sati basically means be really aware of how the mind is making a self and understand it as an impersonal process and liberate the mind from craving and clinging. So, visicca, confounds that. There's different elements to it. The first is V, which basically means apart, asunder, or in different directions, often conveying division, separation, or preoccupation over analysis, so to speak. Chit or citta is associated with thinking, perceiving, or investigating. And is it this term is developed in terms of Buddhist doctrine. It also contains an element of uncertainty or puzzlement regarding investigation. Basically, cha, the last syllable, is just something that is used to describe a noun. Visicca. Subjectively, it's wavering or indecision. in the context of four important elements. The path itself, for example, is this practice even worth doing? The teachings, whether the teachings are valid or not, one's own capacity, and finally, whether the teacher is reliable, authentic, sufficiently well informed. So, in your immediate experience, it's, the mind is kind of hooked in this loop that it keeps reiterating. So there's not an ability to commit to, your go, no-go function in the brain is disabled. There's an area of the brain that's associated with initiating action. And with skeptical doubt, it's stuck in a go, no-go kind of perplexity. A lot of over-analysis, overthinking, second-guessing, doubting. And it's hard to really, it's hard to pay attention to it skillfully because it seems so compelling, particularly when it's about your practice. There's a book that I've used as a resource, and actually it was a resource for one of our study groups called Unhindered, A Mindful Path Through the Five Hindrances by a fellow named Gil Fronsdahl. Excellent book. Well, Gil Fronsdahl is a really excellent teacher, one of the people I have confidence in as a teacher. So here's a quote from that book. Hindering doubt is not the same as questioning doubt. Doubt as a hindrance leads to inaction, sometimes to giving up. Questioning doubt inspires action and the impulse to understand. It can, in fact, be helpful for mindfulness to have a questioning attitude that encourages deeper investigation. It's a healthy doubt that can both overcome complacency and loosen preconceived ideas. There's a very well respected book, one of the first books I ever read about Buddhism many, many years ago, called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I think it's by Suzuki, if I remember correctly.
D.T. Suzuki, I
Yeah.
think. Yeah.
So that whole notion of beginner's mind is what this useful questioning is about. Another way to describe it, perhaps in more contemporary psychological terms, is analysis paralysis. We might be confronted with a decision at a crossroads about which way to go. Should we go to the right? Should we go to the left? Hoping that repeating this thinking, feeling loop about the alternatives, you have to be sure to have the right answer. One that is absolutely the best fit for the job. No regrets, no second guessing. But the mind gets hooked into this doubting loop and disables that ability to be decisive, to take action. And one of the characteristics of skeptical doubt is a misperception that it's about the content. Whatever the circumstances are, which path of the road do we take? Do we go to the right? Do we go to the left? Or maybe we turn around and go back the way we came, right? So analysis paralysis leaves you stuck at that intersection. When we're trying to make a choice, the urgency of having to make the best choice or a concern or confusion about what the consequences of any choice will be is what the paralysis is about. And of course, what really goes on, ironically, is that you stay stuck at the crossroads. So a decision has been made, right? The mind has settled into this doubt loop. So what I want to do is describe these different characteristics of doubt about the path, the teachings, capacity, and the teacher in more detail. I want you to think about how this might apply to you, these different aspects of doubt. And I'm not saying that that's all there is about skeptical doubt. We also, like I said, whether you go to the right or to the left at an intersection, it's not really about the Dharma. It's about the content. You need to make the right choice. It's got to be the perfect choice. This is more about the doctrine, the Buddhist teachings, but the same process applies. So it's important to understand that Buddhism is all about process. Content is circumstantial, right? But the process of being able to pay attention and take action with appropriate diligence, you know, that wholesome questioning is valuable. That's what we're really focusing on. And that's really what these four categories are focusing on. So the first one is doubt about the path. We live in a culture that's not very introspective. We're strongly conditioned to be influenced. We live in a consumer culture. So along with that lack of introspective awareness, it's also difficulty with emotional self-regulation. Right? It's really difficult things that we have to deal with. Once again, I want to invite you to think about how this might apply to your own practice experience. That's this topic and the other topics. Hopefully we'll have some time to kind of talk about that a little bit after I get through explaining it. So introspective awareness, training for self-discipline. This system that Buddhism espouses, the Four Noble Truths, which includes the Noble Eightfold Path, counters this lack of introspective awareness and counters the reactivity that we're conditioned toward as consumers. When I say consumers, I'm not just talking about material goods. I'm also talking about consumers of ideology. It's important to be aware that Four Noble Truths counters this. And this is what I will be calling the path as we go forward with discussion. So this also involves what's called in psychological terms, an external locus of control. I talk about lack of introspection. So what that, what we can expect from that is understanding that our sense of value, what makes life worthwhile, our sense of self-worth is linked to, dependent on whatever kinds of things you possess or want to possess or whatever kind of social status you have or might seek, right? So those factors actually, it's a topic I often talked about as a psychotherapist with my clients, is they're driven by some kind of external expectation. And it really confuses them and it's distressful. So that makes it meet the characteristics of dukkha. So when these possessions or this status determines our self-worth, when circumstances change, when a new car gets scratched, or we don't look as good as we think we should look, socially, right? We don't get the respect that we think we should have. We're distressed by that. So part of what skeptical doubt involves is encountering performance anxiety, right? How am I going to do with this? Am I going to do it right? And of course, the Noble Eightfold Path, it's about right effort, right speech, right action, so forth and so on. But it's a different emphasis, different point of focus. It's about the process. The Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path is all about process. Like I said earlier, content is circumstantial. Whatever we might possess or whatever status we might seek determines how we're doing with life. So the path doesn't emphasize that. The path emphasizes what we can call an internal locus of control. What that means is your ability to stay present with the practice is important. It's a skill set, a craft, right? That's important, the path. But it does not define you. How well, whether you're a good meditator or not, it doesn't define you. It's all about how do you do the practice? How do you notice being hooked by an external locus of control and be able to let that go? Letting it go provides an internal locus of control, something that happens in your own process, regardless of what external circumstances might be. So, living in the world that way, as we bring things into play, the second of these considerations arises, which is doubt about the teaching. I mentioned, the value, my personal valuing of the Noble Eightfold Path, which you could say is an external locus of control, but it really isn't. It's a training protocol. That's what it is. It's a training protocol. It's about a skill set and about a certain kind of aesthetic. So doubt about the teaching prevents moving your meditation further along in terms of self-awareness and self-discipline. Course, the ultimate aspiration of the path is complete liberation, nirvana. But I've talked about this before. In my practice, I used to want to have that big prize, the nirvana, right? Now it's just, how can I be more clear about my life experience? How can I be more functional and more beneficial to others in my relationships, right? And once again, that's not driven by needing someone else's praise or being affected by their blame. It just basically means something you choose quite often in 12 steps, doing the next right thing. Next right thing being determined by right speech, right action, right livelihood. So doubt about the teaching is resolved in a couple of ways. One of them is study. When I first started studying Buddhism, the teachers, the people that I was reading were mostly either Western scholars or Easterners who really had not integrated very well into Western culture, Western terminology, concepts, so forth and so on. After some years, some of the people who were my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Larry Rosenberg, and others, and I could go on, list goes on and on because there's a lot now, people who are Westerners who really dove into the practice through meditation and study with Asian teachers and came back and talked about it in terms that I could appreciate and work with. Additionally, there were people who were born into an Eastern culture, like the Dalai Lama, as a matter of fact, or folks like Choyen Trungpa, Sun Sonim in the Korean Zen tradition, who became more and more capable of translating what they had learned in the East to our culture. So doubt about the teaching can be overcome, first of all, by doing some careful reading, right? Reading that does not fall into skeptical doubt, but into that useful questioning doubt. That kind of applying a particular skill set and really understanding how does this work? Where's the benefit here? Is there any way that it could be done more skillfully? That kind of questioning, the beginner's mind, right? That's one of the ways to not get hooked into skeptical doubt in this context. Of course, in that is your own dedicated practice. There's a famous discourse called the Kalama Sutta. The Kalama were a particular tribe in India. They would invite various teachers, philosophers, to come and make their presentation, and they would critique them, which I think is pretty cool. So the Buddha went there and he made his presentation, and they critiqued him, and they said, "Why should we believe you?" He said, "Well, here's how you do that. You listen carefully from your own base of knowledge, both, conceptual knowledge and your own experiential knowledge. And you apply what you hear diligently, and you keep refining it and see what happens." The term it's used is ehipasiko, come and see. So that's been a core principle of Buddhism as it's been introduced to the West, the Kalama Sutta. Because we are a culture, part of our culture is a questioning culture in the context of scientific research and so forth and so on. However, in terms of our own internal process, as I said at the beginning, we're not really supported in developing our ability to be introspective, to be skillful in that regard. So that's the next one, is doubt about the teaching. The more I study Buddhist concepts and practices, and the more retreats I have under my belt and my daily sitting practice, and my training in psychology. I mean, I was a psychotherapist. I was a Buddhist before I was a psychotherapist. I went to graduate school because I realized that this is a really powerful theory of personality, psychology, and a way to apply psychotherapy. And it was certainly a characteristic of my practice over the decades. So, being able to use psychological terms to understand how the system works helps me to have more confidence in the path. The next one is doubt about capacity to master the teachings and the practice. It's probably the most impactful and the most important one. We want our practice to really, conform to the teachings. They're kind of guidelines, inspirations. And we want to become more skillful. If you want to learn any craft, whether it's, a musical skill or athletic or sculpture or anything like that, you have to practice. And you develop what's called self-efficacy, another useful psychological term. Self-efficacy basically means you have the requisite skills, and determination to bring to bear on a situation. And because of that determination and your practice, you develop what's called self-efficacy. You get better and better at it. Efficacy at acquiring the breath is a really important example in this context. Acquiring your breath basically means that you have trained yourself, your mind, so that you have a formal sitting practice, mindfulness of breathing, but you also find ways to remember, back to sati, remember to pay attention to your breath periodically during the day. It's not possible to do it all the time, but you can develop the skill to recognize opportunities. I do it waiting for a traffic light. I did it a lot as a psychotherapist in therapy and running groups, because I would practice being really mindful, noticing the breath during while I was listening to someone, noticing how my mind was interacting with that, making meaning out of it, using the breath as a stabilizing point of reference, right? So that increases my confidence in terms of the ability to function well. So I think it's very important to consider meditation practice, the whole schema of mindfulness, as a craft. I mean, I was a professional craftsman. I made and sold jewelry for over a decade professionally. So I think about this as a skill set. I also think about it as an aesthetic consideration. I've talked about this many times. I could learn, talking about a different discipline, I could learn to hit the keys on a piano in a certain kind of sequence, a certain kind of timing, and become competent at making the noises associated with what's written on a musical score, right? I could do that. That would not necessarily make it art. It would be craftsmanship. But when my heart is in it, when that self-efficacy, that competency is integrated with a deeper understanding of the aesthetics of music, the craft would become an art. Same thing applies to our subjective experience of being human. It's an art. The skill sets, the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path, promote the development, the art of living, right? Becomes more aesthetically valuable, more beautiful. When I say beautiful, I mean is harmonious, balanced, peaceful, kind, generous, all those things, right? They kind of come along with it. There's that self-efficacy as well. So that's a key part of this countering of skeptical doubt. The hindrance of skeptical doubt involves this, I call it the leading edge of your practice. How attentive are you in any particular moment, particularly when you're sitting? How diligent are you in terms of aiming attention, beginning of the in-breath, sustaining awareness for the duration of the in-breath, and noticing when the mind gets pulled away, and then letting that distraction go and going back to the breath? That's like playing the scales on the piano, right? And then we get better at jamming. So that's what life is, right? Life is improv. And so this is learning how to use the tools of paying attention and self-discipline to improvise our life, which is what we're doing anyway. So the final characteristic about this is doubt about the teacher. I talked earlier about the the teachers who initially, when I first started reading about Buddhism back in the 60s and 70s, were often either Buddhist scholars or Easterners who really didn't have the vocabulary or the cultural understanding to be able to bring it to our experience. But then there was a wave of Westerners who went to India and Southeast Asia and came back with this and put it into contemporary terms. They're my peers. Some of them are in their mid-80s and some of them are in their late 70s, and I'm right in the middle of that. So having a sense of the authenticity of a teacher overcomes doubt. And one of the antidotes for skeptical doubt that's actually recommended is consulting with a knowledgeable person. How do you know that they're knowledgeable? Well, first of all, they have a sense of the doctrine that they can articulate that really your study can sort of resonate with it. That makes sense. That doesn't make sense. And even if it doesn't make sense, some of what I learned from Shyla Catherine don't really make sense to me in terms of my own practice. But I really, really value what she did provide me with. That was very, very important for my development in meditation. So becoming more discerning, more sophisticated in your reading comes about because you become more discerning in your practice. They feed on each other. The other concern, which is really very contemporary, is what's called McBuddhism. It's or Buddhism light. It basically it's framed as a way to manage your stress so you'll be a better worker, right? And there's value in being less stressed, being more effective as you go through your day, whether it involves what you do get paid for doing, or whether it's driving to work, or whether it's hanging out with your friends, or taking care of business, paying a mortgage, so forth and so on. The ability to put all that together, you kind of can pick that up with when you're with somebody, when you're talking to a teacher or reading what they've written. And it goes past just being a more effective worker bee. It becomes something that's more of a spiritual adventure, which I really value. The other part that we're struggling with is that we are being inundated with propaganda that is meant to instigate skeptical doubt about cultural norms, about what's really valuable in life, about dishonesty being okay, right? That violates all kinds of spiritual principles. And so we're confronted with that. How do we respond to that in terms of the teachings of Buddhism, but also in consulting with a teacher? So I'm going to talk a little bit about this looping process that I stated, I talked about a little earlier. The brain has several different subsections where visual processing occurs, auditory processing occurs, somatosensory, gustatory, olfactory. All of these different sensory gates are processed in different parts of the brain, but it's all interconnected. There, all this processing is going on simultaneously. The way I think of it is like there's all these different channels going on in my brain all the time. Which channel am I tuned into? And how is that tuning operating in terms of either increasing my distress and confusion or liberating the mind from distress and confusion? So Information comes in and it's coded. One of the things that we know from contemporary neuroscience is that the sense of self involves a series of momentary emerging interdependent systems interacting in the brain. That moment emerges, falls away, comes together again, falls away multiple times a second. The best way to understand this is old motion picture films. They all, like a the film strip has a photograph in it, a series of photographs. They all look the same unless there's an editing cut between two of the photographs. You put it into a projector, the right speed, the right focus, and the flashing, those images flash on the screen for a fraction of a second, multiple times a second. The image comes and goes and comes and goes. And the way the brain operates blends them all together. In Buddhism, it's actually called a binding moment of consciousness. So this all comes together, right? The meaning making comes from our own personal database, our history, the way we've been conditioned. I talked about we're not very supported in becoming skillful at introspection and self-discipline. But we can change the database. Basically, it's another way to talk about changing your karma, right? With this practice. So the primary analysis, excuse me, antidote for skeptical doubt is a confirmation, a quality of clarity, and a higher degree of certainty. One of the characteristics of skeptical doubt is you're trapped in uncertainty, right? Now, when I say certainty, I don't mean that what comes together in the mind when you're being skillful with this is certain. It just is that the integrative process is very well managed and provides the most opportunity for effective interaction with the situation and self-efficacy in terms of making appropriate adjustments in an ongoing way, right? That's part of the brilliance of this whole system, this Buddhist system. That we're training to notice the transitory nature of subjective awareness, impermanence, and the impersonality of what the mind creates that we call a self, right? It's a concoction, it's a storyline, and feelings come with it in a body. So I mentioned earlier the parts of the brain that are associated with go, no go. It's actually a collection of neurons in the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which has been studied a lot in relative to addiction. One of the characteristics of addiction is that the nucleus accumbens is kind of stuck in a go pattern when it comes to substances or other kinds of behaviors that are unwholesome. That's one of the things that characterizes an addiction, that the consequences are not beneficial. But with skeptical doubt, the go, no-go function becomes paralyzed, inoperative. The mind, two things are going on. One of them, and once again, I mentioned at the very beginning of the evening, I want you to, as I'm talking about this, try to relate it to your own experience. Maybe we can talk about it a bit. But what goes on with this is that the stimulus occurs. Right, encoded, and the initial coding is this food or poison? In other words, is what's emerging in the mind frightening and need to be avoided, which is aversion and ill will, that hindrance, or is it beneficial? Is it something that we want that's going to make life better? Right, that's the hindrance of sense desire. So. As this process is operating, the ability to read what's going on in the body, the felt sense of urgency, of uncertainty, is combined with a preoccupation about what's the right choice. Right? And I mentioned that usually is in the context of what the world thinks is the right choice. Being a millionaire supposedly is, you know, the right choice. But a lot of millionaires are not very happy people. A lot of them are happy people. It's not about the money. It's about internal locus of control. But skeptical doubt kind of hinders the process of being able to function effectively in a world that seems to demand certain loyalties and certain behaviors to be okay. Right? So, the mind can't land on an operational decision. Right? That's part of what goes on with the nucleus accumbens too. There's an operational decision. It's not the only part of that triggering, but it plays a role in it that's been well researched. And as I mentioned earlier, the indecisiveness, the uncertainty makes us skeptical about all kinds of things in our culture. Values, priorities, you know, appearances, so forth and so on. And that contributes to the narrative part of the skeptical doubt. So once again, there's a kind of a felt sense of urgency, a tension associated with skeptical doubt. Now, somehow or other, we want to be able to pull the trigger, right? But we can't. When I say pull the trigger, I mean take action. And the mind keeps running that over and over again, which makes this hindrance operate in ways that are very cooperative with restlessness and worry. Restlessness is an overactive nervous system, a hormonal system. Mind is agitated, the body is tense. And the worry, the mind gets preoccupied with what did go wrong or what could go wrong, right? And that loops into the skeptical doubt thing very nicely, right? The one that I haven't figured out how to connect to this is sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, basically the tranquilizing function, the sedating function in the system is overactive. So the mind gets really dull and heavy. It's called sinking mind. And you're not able to really think about decisions at all, right? It's a different kind of, it's not like paralysis. It's more like being stuck in the mud. That's what goes on with skeptical doubt, is it compromises our ability to pay attention and make course corrections in terms of our thoughts and our behaviors. So specific remedies, I already mentioned one of them, which is consulting with a knowledgeable person. Right? And the whole notion of what is confidence? There's a term in Buddhism called shada, and basically it's translated as faith, or more specifically, confidence. Now, faith in the Western view has an external locus of control. I have faith in Jesus as my savior, right? I have faith in Allah. But Buddhism emphasizes an internal locus of control. So the faith is more associated with the confidence of self-efficacy, the ability to know that you can handle the consequences of any choice that you make as best as you can. Maybe not perfectly, maybe not successfully, but somehow or other, you can bring more resource to the situation, mentally and in terms of your emotions and your behaviors. So, different levels of confidence. First one's conceptual confidence. You read about something, you hear about something, it makes sense. It's logical. But that's not really going to help very much. I mean, it might be a motivator, it might be useful to bring to your practice. But in and of itself, knowing the right thing to do is not necessarily associated with you actually being able to do it. And 12 steps, another phrase is, you have to make move from just being able to talk the talk to being able to walk the walk, right? The next level is seeing someone use the tools. So in terms of first example, you might read about how to use a chisel and other tools to carve wood, make a sculpture. Doesn't mean you can do it. You might observe somebody doing it. You see them use the tools. You see how they shape the sculpture. That's very helpful. Doesn't mean you're going to be able to do it, though. Just because I watch somebody be really skillful playing the guitar doesn't mean I can pick it up and play it myself. Right? So the next level involves practice, learning how to use the tools skillfully. Like I alluded to earlier with the piano, that you learn how to hit the keys, the right keys with the right sequence, right? In the right time. And in terms of performance, you can Mac and put together a melody that is recognizable, let's say, but it's not necessarily beautiful. So that's the third level of confidence, is that kind of, I know I can sit and watch the breath, but how skillful am I in living my life, right? Watching the breath meditation to a large extent is like practicing playing the piano. It's for craft. But there's also an aesthetic that's involved in terms of what you pay attention to and how you manage the stream of consciousness. That's what makes living into an art form. And that's the fourth level of confidence, that it's what I call the aha moment. You get insights into how the system works and how things change for you in terms of your self-efficacy, your internal locus of control. And you can bring that to all life circumstances, not always perfectly. Once again, part of doubt requires that whatever choice I make, it's always going to turn out right. I'm always going to do it perfectly. People are always going to be proud of me. No, it's been a right thing to do based on the Four Noble Truths, Noble Eightfold Path. That's what the guiding factor is, those elements. And you can do that. You know you can do that. That's the aha moment. I think what I want to do now, there's still more stuff in the notes, but I want to leave time for us to talk a little about what the implications of this information might have for you, and in put this in the field of the discussion tonight. Basically, the level of confidence for you might be, well, I heard this guy talk, and I have some sense of what the Dharma is, the concepts are, so I have that kind of confidence. But what hinders your ability to actually put it into play? What is it about the information that you're getting about how skeptical doubt operates that you can sort of articulate, think out loud about? And that might be informative for other people. It might also be informative for you. So, any questions about what you've heard, or any insights about how you can understand and work with your own experience of skeptical doubt? John?
I always think of the word balance and then the word mindfulness, because it's kind of like a pairing. You have to keep yourself alert to what you're doing to yourself, or else you'll get caught. Your brain will jump right in and take over. And I think that is the reason that I sit, is that I'm able to keep aware of the breath, and with awareness and with that non-thought, which is the breathing, I'm able to, keep the act going,
Do you have any
Dance.
experience of doubt about
Sure.
that? And
Absolutely.
how do you contend with that?
I go back to breath. I get off that thought.
And how does that help?
That allows me to balance
That's right.
better and to just let it be, you know what I mean? And allow me to get out of my head. And it's quite a process, and I'm glad I've gotten the habit to bounce and stay present and not get too caught up. Because this boy can sure, you can listen to the news, you can get popped in a blink,
Because there's a lot of skeptical doubt there.
Absolutely.
Okay, Karen.
Hi, Peter and everybody. I really appreciated this talk. I must say it's probably one of the most important ones I've heard. So it takes time. And I wanted to share that since I moved to Colorado, I have more freedom. My daughter's here to help me with my dog, et cetera, et cetera. But I also got involved with the Sangha here that meets every morning. And I am going to go on a retreat in a couple of weeks. And just last Saturday, I sent an email and I had like this sense of urgency. I kept thinking, should I send it or not? But I sent an email to the teacher, knowing she was going to be out of town, and just said that I wanted to. Like 30 minutes to talk to her because I even used the worry, worry. I'm worried. And what I'm worried about, what I said I was worried about, and I think you named it performance anxiety, but what I said was I was worried about having to share the bathrooms with people. At the retreat center, and getting up early in the morning, because I'm not a real early riser. And so I do have skeptical doubt about this. And I think it's more for me, I think it's the first one you talked about. I don't doubt I don't doubt the teachings, and I don't doubt the teacher. I doubt myself.
That's the second one.
Is that the second one?
Maybe it's third on the list. But yeah,
Doubt about
it's doubt of your
teaching.
own ability to use the facilities and perform, right? So the antidote for that, did you contacted the teacher, asked for support? That's one of the antidotes, right? Another antidote is to well, and you're asking me. That's another antidote, right? The other antidote will be that when you start to encounter the experience on the retreat, some of it's going to be worry, some of it's going to be restlessness, some of it's going to be desire, some of it's going to be aversion, some of it's going to be dullness, some of it's going to be doubt. But being able to clearly note the characteristics of the hindrance, and then just keep determining to disengage from that and go back to the breath. And when I say disengage from that, what I mean is that loop. There's two elements to the loop. One of them is physical and emotional, surge of energy in your body, muscle tension, butterflies in your stomach, racing heart, whatever, right? And the other one is the storyline that comes with it. Now, when you use breath awareness and you decide that no matter what goes on, you're just going to go back to the breath, no matter what the doubt is, no matter what the worry is, you're just going to go back to as pure and unfiltered awareness of what's going on in your breath and your body. That's going to disengage the physical part from the storyline. And the more you can relax the body, particularly on the out breath, you just keep letting go with the out breath. The more you'll be able to disengage from doubt, right? And I used that at my last self-retreat. Incidents of doubt would come up about how I was going to arrange the pattern of sitting. I changed my routine. I used to sit 2 hours on the cushion, 2 hours on the recliner. Decided to change that because I had doubts that I would be able to do that because it was really hard for me previously. So I tried something different. An hour on the cushion, 2 hours on the recliner, and it worked just fine, right? But I could have gotten caught up in doubt, and I have gotten caught up in doubt before and ended retreats because of that. At the end of a long retreat, doubt can come up because the mind kind of gets some sense of urgency. But being able to see it as a condition of the mind, not necessarily what has to determine the next step, frees up the go, no-go function. And you just go back to sitting. That's how
That's
you
a
get the antidote.
no go, no go was important information for me. And I would say, just me, for who I am, is a difficult, it can be difficult to unfreeze it. You
Why we
see?
call it practice. It's a skill set. It's like realizing that you keep having a hard time hitting the right key on the piano. You're either going to become doubtful and stop practicing, or you're going to be willing to accept that mistakes will occur, imperfection will occur. You're going to keep practicing. And going back to the breath, letting go and going back to the breath is the primary skill set for this practice.
Thank you, Peter.
Welcome,
That's
Satish.
fine.
So there's a skeptical doubt. What other kind of doubt there is?
There's what they're called, what they call it, beneficial doubt or useful doubt, questioning doubt. That's what it was, questioning doubt. And the questioning basically means your perception of what's going on in the mind is in the context of recognizing that the mind is making things up as we go along. Are the things beneficial for liberation or are they detrimental for liberation? Okay, so when the mind starts to get hooked into, for example, I can't do this, that's not liberating. Now, the assumption is when I say I can't do this, what it means is that my ability to function has been compromised. So I'm going to try something different. That's the appropriate questioning, right? The ultimate questioning is about the notion that there's an enduring autonomous self. You know, when you get deep into my practice on a retreat, it's more along the lines of, what is this? It's not so much along the lines of what am I doing this right or doing this wrong? It's sort of like, what is this selfing? What is this? What's going on here? So it's more of a kind of an existential question rather than a procedural question. And that's where the practice really reaches its fulfillment.
To me, skepticism and doubt are synonyms.
Well, but I'm inviting you to think of it differently in the context of being, that's what beginner's mind is all about, is having that kind of questioning, on a qualified understanding that's open to revisiting and revising in ways that are more likely to promote freedom from suffering. That's the protocol. And you have to be questioning. Otherwise, you get too attached to a particular idea or expectation. My practice has changed over the years, because more different skill sets became more workable, and different understandings were revealed by those different skill sets. So I have more and more confidence that I know how to make this work in terms of awakening. But I have to question all along, I have to question, can this be changed for the better? Can this be changed for the better? Steve, wait, my first is blah, 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 blah. Who was it? Robin. First it's Robin and then it's Steve.
Yes, thank you so much for this. It was just amazing to hear this put in such a succinct way. And yeah, I was thinking about doubt, that frozen doubt that I used to get into, where I was so afraid to make a decision that I would make the wrong decision. And then the perfectionism kicks in. You know, you have to make the perfect decision. Like every part of your life depends on this. And moving out of that doubt into you know, we talked about faith, you know, belief in something else, that if you make this decision based on all those things you talked about, you know, then that decision may be wrong for you, it may be right for you, but it's a decision, and you will either learn from it or you will grow from it. So I love the way you put that. It was just very you know, enlightening, and that practice of the aha moments. There's nothing so rewarding as an aha, you know, moment, and you're like, oh, that's what that is, you know, and you'll feel like you're five again. But it doesn't matter, because you know, you've fed your soul that little bit of information, and like you said, it was no longer a craft; it became an art. And I've never heard that art and craft analogy before, and I thought that was just brilliant. So I just wanted to thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I hope it continues to be useful. Steve.
Hey Peter, thanks so much for the talk tonight. I get concerned sometimes when there is the absence of doubt, that you know, like you say, you're clinging to beliefs, and I have no doubt at all. And that, yeah, it's so important to just always be inquiring, always that questioning doubt is so important to avoid getting caught up in that narrative in which, you know, we're just there in the comfort of whatever our beliefs are, and not questioning a thing, and not feeling doubt.
Yes. I mean that the underpinning of skeptical doubt of all the whole practice is uncertainty. In fact, there's a term that's applied to dukkha. It's called viparinama dukkha, and it's technically it's described as the what happens when happiness goes away. But my understanding of it is that it's the distress and confusion that we're all confronted with because life is uncertain. You know, life is reliable most of the time, but the exceptions can be troublesome, right? And you might make the best choice based on what you know, and yet something changes. To use a phrase, it rains on your parade. You know, you organize this parade. You thought it through, you're putting all the elements together perfectly, and damn, it rained, right? So that's an important thing to understand about this practice in terms of self-efficacy. Okay, when it rains, I'm not going to get swamped. I'm going to, you know, make the best choices, and it might mean just saying canceling the parade. right? But that requires some flexibility. You become fixated on, we're going to have this parade even if everything gets destroyed, then that's unwholesome, right? So we learn how to make our best guess of the right approach and then adapt, make appropriate adjustments.
Certainly feel better with certainty, right? The belief that, something we think has some certainty to it, right? Some solidity to it.
Yeah, and of
I
course, we can be pretty certain that the sun's going to rise in the east, right? Whether or not I'm going to be awake or even alive to see it is uncertain, right? And the time that the sun arises might be inconvenient in terms of my plans. So that's uncertain too, my plans and them meeting with what's actually going on is uncertain. So we learn how to keep our balance, as John alluded to, using breath awareness to keep our balance in that kind of ongoing practice modality rather than being locked into it's got to be this way or else.
On that issue it you raised though of just being at an intersection and not really knowing which way to go, that uncertainty, that's the subject of the little segment from Alice in Wonderland that is right behind
Yep,
which
that's part of the brilliance of that whole story.
yes
It's about a story of uncertainty.
yeah. The discussion that she has with the Cheshire Cat, wondering which way she should go.
Yep. Tweedledee and Tweedledum. Okay, so we've actually run over quite a bit tonight, but I think it's a good process discussion. Next week, the topic is going to be a different part of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the five aggregates, talked by Allie. So I'm looking forward to hearing what Allie's putting together about that. So, as is our custom at the end of our meeting, let's all sit together briefly in silence. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. Hope we're all reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to chat.